Well, welcome back. It's good to be with you all today. No matter where you find yourself, I hope you're having a great start to the summer months. And if you're traveling, if you're in town, we just appreciate you joining us here on Charting the Course. So today we're going to do what I'm calling a summer financial health check. Everybody needs to go to the doctor. Everybody needs to go to the dentist, the orthodontist. You got to get checked up. Well, it's a good time to do a little financial health wellness check. So I've asked Stacy Murray and Kyle Ray, two members of our advisory team here at Full Sail, to sit down with me and go over what I'm kind of labeling as mistakes, pitfalls, horror stories, and tragedies. That may be a little dramatic, but you'll understand here in a second, of all things when it comes to finances. So a quick internet search pulls up really hundreds of them. I've tried to come up with about 10, and yes, Stacy, in no particular order. We're going to go through these. So Stacy, Kyle, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it. How are y'all?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. Stacy?
I am surviving summer. You know, as a working mom, working parent, it is. Summer is hard, but it's kids are loving it. And we're just, I can't believe, I mean, it'll be gone before we know it.
It will. A blink and it's fall and football season and school time. So,
yeah.
Okay. Let's jump in right here. Again, these are in no particular order, but we're just going to start throwing some of these out. I'm going to let Stacy and Kyle interject their thoughts, and then we'll close it up at the end with some just overarching themes and thoughts from just from our seat as advisors. Okay, so off the top, let's look at one that came up on multiple lists, and that's, I just called it cash hoarding. But basically, you're sitting on long-term cash. So I want you guys to differentiate how we would speak to clients or people on what short-term cash is versus long-term cash. And then why it's an issue if you're a cash hoarder.
Sure. I think from Stacy and I's viewpoint, we sit in the advisor chair and doing comprehensive financial planning. We often see clients sitting on an excess amount of cash. And the book would tell you that you should sit on 1 to 2 years worth of living expenses. That's good and fine. But many times clients, if they have the luxury of sitting on excess cash and are making enough money, saving enough money, they often have a higher number in their mind of what they want to see in their bank account. Yeah. But as long-term advisors and long-term planners, Stacy and I constantly, we don't fight with clients, but we try to get them to see the longer-term picture of getting cash back into their long-term asset allocation for longer-term plans. And it feels good getting 5% in your cash right now, but we understand that that's not always going to happen. So we have to constantly push clients to keep putting money back and for longer term objectives.
I would say, yeah, too. I mean, cash hoarding, I see it a lot with my business owners. Cash tends to be warm and fuzzy, right? It's our warm, fuzzy blanket. It makes us feel comfortable. I also see it with kind of our older clients that have moved into the next chapter, retirement stage of life. And they like seeing a certain number for them to put their head on their pillow at night, which is perfectly fine. But Kyle and I's job, and Tyler, your job as well, is to make sure we push those clients a little bit to get out of that emotional bias of saying, I need this amount of cash, and make sure it's working correctly. I think a lot of my clients that come to me want to say, oh, if I'm not in cash, I've got to be in equity. And you can't forget about fixed income. We haven't talked about fixed income in quite a while, just because, you know, 2 to 3 years ago, you were getting 2%. It wasn't worth having your money in. But fixed income right now is a great opportunity to shift clients that have been cash heavy into fixed income to allow it to keep up with inflation. There's some great charts out there, amazing charts. And you'll see, okay, if I hold on to cash for $10,000 over a 10, 15 year period versus a 60-40 portfolio, meaning equity and fixed income versus an equity portfolio, you can just see the graphs, and that graphs just tell you and paint the picture of cash will not keep up with inflation.
Right. It can't. It's not built that way. So, okay, good differentiator there. I think the main thing I would add is just what is long-term cash, what is short-term cash? And there's a difference. So, all right, moving on. Buying / holding on to an asset that you can't maintain. So house, car, second home, third car, whatever it is, you name it. What do you guys see from your seat on this idea?
Yeah, I have a great example on that. I think it's second homes. You know, I think people more, it was kind of COVID timing and everything that people wanted to go in and buy second home vacation homes, right? And they were going to do the VBRO, and it's so easy to make money, and it's always going to be rented out. And there's studies out there, but if you don't have it rented out, like 65 or 70% of the time, you're not even breaking even on it. And so I tell a lot of my clients, I know it's going to sound really sexy to have a vacation home in Colorado, to have one in Arizona, Florida, wherever you want to say, but it's honestly better financial planning to do a VBRO. Go out there for the entire summer. Go out there and rent one for 2 months. Maybe you'll see, hey, I want to go somewhere else. I want to be somewhere different. But there's just so much cost associated with a second home. It really starts to eat up the living expenses and your financial independence that you have generated and kind of bucketize over. And I just think people think the second home makes it seem wealthy, luxury. I think you can do it in a different limelight and still have the goals that you want to have by why you would want a second home.
Yeah, I think I see that. And I also see cars. Obviously, we have to have cars. Can't get around without them. But what I often see is in the pitfall, a big pitfall with clients is buying a car every year or every 2 years or having additional cars. And a car, as everyone knows, there's very few cars that can appreciate. They almost appreciate right off the lot. So that is something that is sometimes detrimental to cash flow and really detrimental to allowing that client to continually save, whether they're paying cash or financing it. That is cash that could be used for longer term objectives, and getting clients to not want that new car every year is a mindset shift, but it's one that can be pretty powerful if you can get away from that.
That's a great point. Yeah. And I think second home can also refer to lake houses. You know, here in Oklahoma, we love our lake houses, but those do get expensive and you use them 3 to 4 times a year.
I think the maintenance part there is whether it's your own house, your primary house, your lake house, your car, your second home, whatever it is, it's that maintenance cost. I don't think people built in. So yeah, you can afford the house today, but what's it going to cost to maintain in the long run? So, okay, this one we can spend a lot of time on, so I'll have to, we'll do our best to rein it in. Improper or lack of diversification. And I'm going to frame it up and tee it up in the sense of clients, individuals, families that have a majority of their wealth in one stock, so one company. And I know Stacy's got some examples there. They've got all their stock into one asset, maybe a business, all their stock into one piece of property. The land is going to appreciate someday, so I'm going to have all my eggs in that basket. So we kind of flip it on its head. We really want broad diversification. If you listen to us at all, at any point, we preach diversification. So how do you guys handle these conversations when people put their money, put their wealth into one specific single item, if you will?
Yeah. So I've seen this kind of two sides. I've seen it from CEOs, CFOs that have came to me and said, hey, I'm getting ready to retire in the next 2 to 3 years. I want to start working with a wealth advisor to kind of see how I want to start diversifying out. And then I also see it with business owners that they have all of their financial wealth into their business.
Sure.
And they have not created financial independence outside of that business. And so I don't want to be devil's advocate, but I have to look at them in the face and say, look, I know that this company provided 38 years, great service, provided for your family, everything along the lines, but that public stock may not be here in 5 to 10 years.
Right.
We don't know. But what we do know is we've got to get diversified. And so you've got to work with those business owners. And it's the same thing with business owning businesses. You've got to make sure that your business owners are pulling out cash and paying themselves first. There's a great book out there. But you got to make sure you pay yourself first and you don't have everything tied up to one asset, whether that is, like Tyler said, one business or that's one stock. I'll pick up my husband. He works for Amazon. You know, they get paid in stock. And so you've got to make sure that you're diversifying out of that. And I think the best thing to do, and what I've heard, is it's easier to be all half right or half wrong versus all right or all wrong.
Right.
And what I mean with that, and I use it with all of my, like my CEOs, CFOs, is I don't know what this stock's going to do in the future. My grandpa owned Sears. I mean, he worked for Sears for 45 years and Sears is no longer around, right? So we never think that our company, like Amazon's not going to be here, but we have to plan for the what if. And we also need to make sure that we are protecting the nest egg. I like to tell business owners, look, you did all the hard work. You went in, you created your financial wealth. Now let's make sure we protect the principal. And we're going to protect the principal by being highly diversified. And being highly diversified is not having it all in one thing. I know you, Kyle, worked with kind of Paycom here recently mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah, I often see with a lot of small, medium-sized business owners as well, not necessarily public companies, but private small companies, they've got, you often see clients have, you know, north of 80, 90% of their net worth tied up in this private business. And it's performed very well and it's exploded their net worth. And they've worked very hard at it, but it's hard. A good conversation to have is continually working cash out and just completely away from that business, not correlated at all. So that if, and you see a lot of businesses fail, if your business does fail, you've got something on the sides to support you. Statistically, a lot of businesses do fail. And that I think that's hard to sit across the table from a business owner and say that might happen to your business, but it is something as a fiduciary and investment manager that we have to plan for, and that we want to plan for your plan to work without your business needing to work all the time and getting cash out and away from that business is a good way to do it. And then the last thing I would say we see, and especially lately, is the clients who want to chase, or the people in general who want to chase the hot thing. So a couple of years ago, that was Bitcoin. Right now, it's kind of meme stocks or Nvidia stock.
Right.
Just continually staying diversified wins over a long period of time. And oftentimes, you're never going to get in those assets early enough to make it worthwhile. And you're just creating a lot of risk in one place.
How have you guys handled the conversation? The younger generations are getting a little better at this. I'm not picking on the older generations because they're a lot smarter than we are. But I see it a lot with some individuals who want to diversify their money managers, their banks, their you name it. How do you guys handle that conversation? Because I think just as detrimental as putting all of your wealth into one place, one stock, one company, and not diversifying away, I think you can have some over-diversification when you're trying to put your money in all these different places. So how do you guys handle that conversation with a potential client or current clients?
Yeah, I think there's two points here. So from a investment manager standpoint, so our seats, mm-hmm. our strategies, we're diversified across 12,000 global stocks, 20,000 global bonds if you have fixed income in your portfolio, and then alternatives as well. If you mix investment managers, what you often see is overlap in strategy and often an over-concentration in a certain area.
Sure.
And quite frankly, a lot investment managers, if they're using some of the same tools, you're not really diversified in the way that you think you are. You're just overexposed in certain areas. You also lose breakpoints in fees. There's a lot of reasons to pick one investment manager. And I would say now on the banking side, there are valid reasons, whether you're a small or medium-sized business owner, to hold more than the FDIC insured level. There's reasons to do it, especially if you've got a lot of inflows and outflows and cash flow in your business. But now banks have the ability to parcel out your cash on the back end and insure it with other partner banks. So that's been a really powerful thing. In my opinion, you can have one investment manager and you can have one bank. Simplification is pretty key in our area, and mm-hmm. that goes a long way to helping.
It's a great example.
Yeah.
Would you add anything there, Stacey?
I see it as well. With kind of my older clients, and not picking on them like Tyler said, but my older clients of I've got some money at Wells Fargo, I've got some money at Bank of Oklahoma, I've got some money here, and then I've got money with you. And I think the struggle is the financial planning is really hard to do. And I look at my clients, I say, look, I don't want to compete with those others. If you have more trust in what they're doing, you need to move your assets under them. To Kyle's point, absolutely fiduciary. You get better discounts on fees by doing that. But the other thing is asset allocation, making sure that it's all working together correctly, that you're also being strategic in the financial planning. And I think that that's key to have. I had a great example of a client that had some money at Bank of Oklahoma. We start looking through his portfolio. He had no idea he had alternatives in there. So we had already added alternatives here because he had told me he didn't have any. We go to look at his Bank of Oklahoma. He's got alternatives. So it's, again, all parties have to work together.
Right.
At the end of the day, you have to find a wealth manager that you trust mm-hmm. and that you know is going to be there when you're not there for your family members. Once you've found that person, honestly, I mean, at the end of the day, like the investing is probably not going to be too different, you know, the way we're all moving. Especially with low cost ETFs, utilizing all that. So at the end of the day, find that relationship manager that you trust and will know that will be there for your family. I think that's the most important thing you can do.
And I think it surprises people is we're not afraid. Heck, half the time we're trying to, you know, help convince clients to stay put where they are or help consolidate into a different place because we think that's in their best interest
right.
and they've got a relationship. And so we're not afraid to have those conversations at all. And I think that speaks very highly of our team of advisors. Okay, I'm going to loop these next two in together because I think we can hit on both of them and they play into each other. That's one, excessive spending, and two, excessive borrowing. And I don't care. We were talking about this off air. I don't care if you have $10,000 in your bank or $10 million in your bank. Both of those individuals can fall into this trap. So excessive spending, excessive borrowing. What do you guys see there as far as just a health and wellness in finance world, what's the detriment there? And why does that creep up on people so fast, no matter what their net worth is?
I'll say just a couple of things. And then Kyle, I'll definitely pass this one over to you because I know you've had some great examples as well. I see this a lot with, you know, my Henrys. I like to refer to them as high earners, but not rich yet. And the fact of that it tends to be kind of your healthcare, your physicians, your doctors, not trying to pick on them. They've came out of school. They had a ton of student debt. They did a really good job. They got their student debt paid off. They maybe have not been savings into their qualified plans because if they work for OU, OU Health does a great job of adding incentives into their qualified bucket. So they're kind of like, okay, oh, you saving for me. Mm-hmm. So I don't necessarily have to save. And I've paid off all my student loan debt and I'm working a ton of hours. I'm going to take my family on these crazy trips, have the nicest houses, cars, private schools, all of that. Well, then they get up into their 60s, 65, 70, and they're ready to call it quits. And they'll come in and they'll have their financial statements kind of in push it across from their 401ks. And they've got about $1 million. And that's not going to save up with their lifestyle of the way that they've been spending. And so I think that's the excessive spending that I see is it's just people kind of, I don't want to say living above their means. It's not that they're on credit card debt. It's just they're not prioritizing kind of the right tranches. And back to Kyle's point, you know, financial planning is all about setting the right expectations and goals. So you know what you can live off of. And that's kind of what I truly see on the excessive spending piece. And I know, Kyle, you had a couple as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think this is why a good financial plan on the front end, and you know, who knows what front end means, because our lives are constantly changing and moving. And it's like, when do you insert that plan? Well, now is, don't wait, put it in place now. But what I have seen as far as excessive spending is it's not always necessarily just discretionary spending too much, you know, eating out or doing this and that, but it could be they bought a house that was too big, and that's looping into debt here. They bought a house that was too big or too expensive for them. They didn't understand the additional maintenance cost outside of just the principal and interest that they have to pay. And because of that, they've really hamstrung their ability to save. So it's not necessarily just discretionary spending. It's just, it might be they made a bad decision with a house or a big purchase on with debt. And then it's led to them not being able to save in the short and long term. So the quicker we can identify issues there, we can make a plan to get out of it or make the best plan and work with whatever's going on at the time. So a plan is just integral to all this.
One thing I've read about a little bit about, and I've seen other kind of financial books or podcasts talk about, is when we went through this extremely low interest rate period, a lot of people, especially now with kind of inflation going up, you had these valuations on their properties getting increased. So people were taking out home equity line of credits and they're using them almost as a checking account and using it to go do things. Well, now all of a sudden, once those rates come, you know, now the rates are higher. So if you're going to, if it comes time to pay off that HELOC and you've got to refinance, you're refinancing into a much higher rate. And there's a time and a place to make improvements and do what is meant to be the reason those HELOCs are around. I've seen more people talk about how those are getting used a little bit inefficiently, if you will, which leads to that excessive borrowing. You build up that debt, and guys, they could be 21 or they could be 65. Debt just straps you down and weighs you down in the sense of you can't then maybe go out and spend what you want to spend. You can't save what you want to save. So any other thoughts on spending borrowing?
Yeah, I think consumer debt, just the credit card debt, don't forget about that. You know, credit card debt, you have to, I have clients coming in and they're talking to me about what do we start prioritizing?
Yeah.
Not all debt is bad. I'm not on that theory. You know, I think it's some people that have home loans and the 3%, great. Like, let's not be in a hurry to pay that off. But if we are looking at credit card debt that, I mean, I saw a statement the other day and I think it was 28, 29%. Like, gosh, it kills me. You got to get rid of that.
And you don't feel it because you just see, I'll make my $48, my $100 minimum payment and kick the can down the road. So,
yep.
Okay, I'm going to do the same thing and we're going to tie two in together here again because I think they go hand in hand. Another mistake, no retirement savings. Stacey, you hit on it, but I want to dive in a little bit more there. But no retirement savings. And then outside of that, so outside of the retirement plans, outside of your SEPs, your Simples, your Roths, also poor to no saving strategy as an individual, as a family, poor to no saving strategy you can pass on and teach to your kids. What do you guys see there? I mean, what are things when you're having those conversations? And Stacey, you hit on it a little bit of maybe not saving enough, but I'm talking about people just flat out don't have any retirement savings.
Yeah, I mean, I think the world that we live in, a lot of us, and I'm going to pick on myself, you know, I think they called us the entitled generation and that mm-hmm. we think that our parents got left something, so we should be left something. And I see it with my friends. My friends say that, oh, my mom and dad are going to leave me something, so we're not saving anything. I'm just going to inherit that wealth. And I hate to be, you know, the devil's advocate on that. But I have seen time and time again that mom or dad, maybe somebody passes away tragically to cancer or whatever that they've had in their life, and the mom and dad remarry. And so new wife or new husband end up living off the inheritance and start utilizing those funds. And so by the time that person then passes, there's not much to be left. And they're sitting there going, well, I was waiting on my inheritance check to come, right? And so I see that a lot is, and I like to, when I work with clients and I do the same thing with my husband, is what's in my bubble and what can we control? And when you think about what's in your bubble and how you live your financial dynasty, it is not controlling your inheritance. Inheritance should be a bonus. Nobody should expect that they're going to receive anything. It should be a bonus because you also, I see it time and time again when I'm dealing with second and third generational wealth, they'll come in and it's usually the spouse that's not in the family, right?
Right. So
it's the
married
spouse. And they're frustrated because all the money is over here. They can see it, but they can't touch it. They can't figure out how to invest it because it's being invested by mom and dad's financial advisor or into the real estate or into the family business that made them all the money. And the struggle is, and I look at them and go, look, I have to worry about you because God forbid if something happened to this individual, it's actually going to go to the grandkids. It's going to skip you entirely. And that just, they look and they're in shock. Like that would never happen, right?
Yeah.
I've got this monthly check coming and the stipend that's coming. Yeah. And what if it ends? And so I think that's the struggle I see is the inheritance just tends to be a bonus. I also, with my business owners, I love working with business owners, but my biggest struggle with them is I'm not going to save it all. I'm going to put it all into my business. And as soon as I cash out, sell my business in 5 to 10 years, then I'm going to bring all the money, right? Like I'm going to bring everything. And to Kyle's point, he probably has the stats. He's our stat guy, but majority of those businesses don't ever sell. And I hate to say that, but it's so hard to get a business to where you're going to be able to really cash it out and be able to have that financial independence. And it's really, guys, it's time value of money. If you start in your 20s, your 30s, and you just start just chipping away at it, you're going to be amazed at how much financial wealth you can build on your own without having to worry about mom and daddy leaving you something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The only thing I would add, kind of just going off of what Stacy said, is that I often just see clients or people, not necessarily clients, but people in general just say, well, I'm not really making what I want to make right now. I'll put some back in retirement when I make, you know, when I make more money. And the hard part is there's two points to this. If you put money, like Stacy said, time value money back away earlier, even if it's a small amount, what that can compound to is so much more powerful than you trying to catch up 20 years later, even if it's a lot less money today. And the other part is if you're not disciplined to put what little you might have on the sidelines back for retirement now, just the psychology behind it, the statistics are, it's pretty likely that you're not going to put it back when you have more. You're going to find other places to spend it. So we always advise just make the hard decision now and the sacrifice of putting a little more, as much or a little more away now for your future self.
I love what you both said. And Stacey, you brought up a really good point of control what you can control. And things that are in your control, how much you save, how much you spend, those are things you can have an influence on. So great points, both of you. Okay, let's move in here. We're wrapping up. Another one that I found popping up occasionally is those people who are using retirement funds. So coming off of not having a straight saving strategy or having retirement savings and using those funds to pay off debt. So we've talked about having debt can be detrimental, and we've talked about having no retirement savings. So what do you say to those people that, well, I'll tap my Roth IRA to pay off debt, or I'll take a loan on my 401k to pay off debt. What's the conversation look like there?
Ultimately, everybody is a little bit different. And if somebody, I hate for that to have to be the decision, but I have seen it where it needs to be the right decision because they're under immense credit card debt for the main part at near 30%. Yep. And sometimes you just have to make that decision.
I think there's a time and a place for it, for sure.
I would say that this is probably even more of a case to try to get money back in a Roth IRA as much as possible, just because it is flexible. I hate to tell clients that you could tap your Roth, at least what you put into the Roth, tax-free if you need it as an emergency, because you don't want clients thinking that way and thinking that, you know, they will and can. But there's a time and place for everything, but both really that bad debt, back to the bad debt, consumer debt can be detrimental to an overall plan. And unfortunately, sometimes we advise clients to make the hard decision of taking money out of a retirement account to pay down incredible, you know, amounts of credit card debt. So we'd like to get ahead of that and just hope that never happens, but we understand that the decisions have to be made.
Yeah.
The only one I've seen, I was kind of shocked on it, and I saw it a few weeks ago, is the spouse didn't know that the husband had taken out from his 401k a loan to allow them to go on a trip. Or, and so again, back to Kyle's point of setting expectations, making sure you're not living above your means. What can you afford? Make sure you guys, the family, the couple is solid, right? And that they're talking and they're communicating and nobody feels that financial stress to really, and I'm going to like, this is going to be my kind of ending, but I think it's a great way to kind of throw it in there is keeping up with the Joneses.
Mm-hmm.
And I use this all the time with my clients. Why is Joneses plural? It's because there's multiple Joan families. What do you mean? There's multiple Joan families? Yeah, there's the Joan family over here. They're your neighbors to the left. And their most important thing to them is cars, to Kyle's point. They love having fancy, fancy cars. So they're going to spend all their money on the cars. You have Joan to the right, the Joan family to the right, and they love trips, luxury trips, all of these things. So that's where they're putting their money. Then you got the Joan family across the street and they're saving into their retirement. You're sitting there looking at them going, man, like they're not making anything, right? But if you step back and look at it, it's the Joneses. And if you try to keep up with the Joneses, you can't keep up with everybody.
Yeah.
So you have to make sure that your spouse, your family is solid and you sit down and say, what are our priorities? Where do we want our bucket of assets, our paychecks to go
mm-hmm.
to make sure that we can sleep at night, that we're staying on track and we're building the things that we want to build. But I love the keeping up with Joneses is plural because nobody has it all. Nobody has it all.
No, you're right. And everybody's situation is different. Don't, it's the keeping up with fill in the blank and it's the comparison trap. It is an absolute financial disease to do that. So, okay, second to last thing, poor tax strategies. And I'm going to limit Stacey and her CPA brain to like 2 minutes here, but poor tax strategy, Stacey. I mean, we can go 1,000 different ways, but high level, what does that mean?
Yeah, I think the best one here, staying to one of them, is business owners, farmers, ranchers. They think at the end of the year, they maybe have profits and they're working with their CPA and they're saying, oh my gosh, I got to go out and buy a whole bunch of property. I got to go buy a new tractor. I've got to go out and buy a new truck. I've got to spend the money so I can bring my profits down, right?
Right.
I need expenses to bring down my profits. And I've got a CPA firm here I work with quite a bit. And I love that they're like, look, if you need it, yes, then go out and do it. But don't go out and buy a new private jet just because you're wanting to have a tax deduction at 35%, right? I mean, it does not make sense. And so if you need it, absolutely. And that's where you can get strategic in tax planning of shifting and saying, do I do it at the end of 24 or do I do it at the beginning of 25, right? Make sure you're looking at those numbers. But I am not a big person on I need to hurry up and spend a bunch of money at the end of the year on equipment that I may not need because you're still having to give up that cash. And I challenge business owners to say, look, if you are sitting on that much cash that you can go out and buy a brand new tractor, new piece of equipment, let's look at doing a cash balance plan. Call me if you want to talk cash balance plans. We don't have time today. Tyler's going to, kill me if I start cash balance plans.
It's a separate podcast.
But separate podcast. Love them. I can't stress enough about them, but I think that's my biggest poor tax strategy that I see a lot.
I think having no strategy, right, too.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, Kyle, absolutely.
I have nothing to add. I come from the part of the state, a little town where a lot of farmers, they will, if they have profits, like Stacey said, they'll scramble around at the end of the year to buy a piece of equipment or a new truck just to not pay taxes. And I think that letting the tax tail kind of waggle your mm-hmm. overall plan is not a good plan. Just not wanting to pay taxes just because you don't want to pay taxes is not necessarily a good plan. If you could put that same amount of money back, like Stacey said, in some type of retirement plan and get the deduction today,
yeah.
well, that's the same thing. And you're keeping money in your pocket for your future self. So
yeah.
there's a lot of powerful tools, we could ultimately talk about with clients and plan for, but we see a lot of, it's mainly comes from small business owners. You see a lot of poor strategies yeah. just because they do not want to pay taxes.
And who does? But again, you guys are spot on. So, okay, the final one, and this came up on, if I Googled, I used AI, any list I tried to find when I was coming up with kind of our outline, this was on here, on every single one. And that is, and you've hit on it, you both have teed it up nicely, but it's not having a plan, not having an advisor, not having a planner, not having not having a tax advisor, a CPA tax planner. That, to me, if you're sitting here listening to us today, during this month of June, and we're doing the summer wellness health check, that to me is the biggest thing is, do you have a plan? Do you have a trusted advisor? Do you have a planner? Commentary there from you too.
No, I mean, I think you hit it perfectly. I think it's like we put off going to the dentist, right? And I mean, this is one of the most important things. I mean, it's like having insurance. You got to have insurance in the stage of life that you're in. And you've got to have a wealth manager, somebody that's going to be there and not to get on the low life of sides of things. You're not always going to be there. And if something happens, you know, Tyler, and you and I have been working with somebody here locally that their spouse passed away tragically at our age, you know, 37, 38. And the other spouse has no idea what to do. And it's so overwhelming. And if they would have had somebody that they could say, hey, look, I know I met you 2 years ago when your wife, your husband was here. I am so sorry you're going through this. You focus on your young kids. We're going to take care of everything for you. And unfortunately, they don't have that situation. And I think that that has really hit home for me being a young mom of three is, God forbid, if something happened to me, who could Brian call? And it's like you got to have insurance just in case something happens. I think you've got to have a wealth manager. You may not be at the level where you need a wealth manager and you're meeting with them every quarter, but you got to at least have that check in with them once a year so they know what's going on and they can step in if something was to happen.
I'm going to take two different angles here. I think a plan is, it's essential. Not having a plan is not a good plan, first of all.
Right.
And then second of all, not all plans are created equal. And I think that some are better than others, but the important thing is just getting a plan in place and staying disciplined to it. And staying disciplined over a long time period of that plan. What we often see with clients as well is, well, we create a plan or they've come in with a different plan, and changing a plan every single year is not a good thing. That changing your strategy, changing your investment strategy, your saving strategy year over year can be just as detrimental to an overall plan as well. But then I think the last piece, and this kind of goes more in line with like investment planning, but within your overall financial plan, a plan brings expectations more in line with reality. 2022 is a hard year. Assets all across the board, essentially except cash, were down. Last year, the S&P 500 was up 26%. And I think it's important to like separate those 2 years apart when you're meeting with clients year over year and say, these 2 years together are normal, but year over year, you shouldn't expect the market to go up 26% average. Like
right.
You shouldn't expect that. That's way out of line. But the bad years also happen. And it just brings expectations more in line with reality of where we should be longer term planning. It's so hard and I understand sitting in the client's seat, it's hard mm-hmm. when you're looking at a performance report year over year of looking at what happened in the last year and really just focusing and being either negative or positive with what has happened in the last year. But just the plan takes a lot of that out of the picture and looks forward 5, 10, 15, 25 years. So yeah.
One thing we always talk about is our job is to take the emotion out of the equation on the investment side. We really do operate kind of under that thought process of we're going to do evidence-based, not emotional-based. Well, everything we've talked about today, though, we didn't talk about any ETF or mutual fund or index fund or investment strategy, which one's better or wrong. We talked about all the emotional conversations. And so I think from the advisor seat when we're meeting with people, these are emotional conversations. So when we say, you know, we just got to take the emotion out of it, we don't mean we're not going to have these conversations. Our job is to go through these, have these conversations, and then we'll put an investment and a plan to place that can take the emotion out. But we fully acknowledge these are all emotional topics, emotional conversations. They're emotional events. Stacey, your example of losing a loved one, losing a spouse, having to talk about an inheritance. It sounds great, but when you're doing an inheritance, somebody has died. Somebody has passed away. Something's happened. Mm-hmm. So, and again, these are all high level. Every single client situation is different. And that is why I think it's so important to, you need a Stacey, you need a Kyle, you need a Max, you need a Hunter, you need somebody in your corner that's going to sit there and that's going to have your back and be able to step in when needed. So any final thoughts here? I sure appreciate it. This was great. Anything else from you two?
No, thank you, Tyler.
Yeah, thank
awesome.
You.
All right, y'all. Everybody have a wonderful rest of the month of June. We'll be back with you in July with a squared away market update. We're going to spend quite a bit of time on just the alternative world, the private investment side of things and the private side of our business and what we're seeing. So as always, we appreciate you joining us. If there's anything we can do for you, please do not hesitate to reach out. We're always happy to have a conversation. So everybody have a great day. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed today's conversation, don't forget to review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week. All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.